Hello, my name is Rabbi Mindy Snyder. I'm the spiritual leader of Congregation Lev Shalom in Flagstaff, Arizona. So I had the good fortune of growing up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where there are many Jews, many different kinds of Jews. The Jewish history in Philadelphia is significant. There was a certain sense of safety and security within my Judaism. I didn't feel othered. And then sometime during high school, the news reported that my synagogue had been vandalized. Things had been stolen out of the Holy Ark. Swastikas were painted on the building. Windows were smashed. And that's when I really started seeing bigger crimes against our people. Violations against the Jewish people through sacred spaces like synagogues, like cemeteries, has been increasing over the past 2 months in particular. The first thing I feel is outrage that people feel they are entitled to or have the right to harm an entire group of people. And whoever is perpetrating these crimes probably doesn't realize that the harm they do to the Jewish community worldwide affects our Muslim friends, our Christian friends. These are family to us. What is not being discussed in the media as much as perhaps as it could be is the relationship between the expressions, and I'm going to use the term hatred of Jews, because anti-Semitism was coined from a German person many years ago, preceding World War II. And, you know, what does anti-Semitism really mean? It almost sounds like a euphemism. So let's talk about hatred. One of the things that is not being discussed is the root of hatred. What hatred really is, how hatred grows, how hatred is perpetuated over generations, how hatred is expressed not only in its most dramatic fashion, like, God forbid, blowing up a building, but there are some very subtle expressions of hatred that one can hear.
Hello, my name is Christian Piccolini, and I am the co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit which helps pull people out of hate groups. I was a member of America's first neo-Nazi skinhead gang. I was first recruited in 1987. I was a normal kid, and at 14 years old, I was searching for something that all young people search for. I was looking for an identity, and a man came up to me one day when I was smoking a joint in an alley, and he looked me in the eyes and he grabbed the joint from my mouth and he crushed it with his boot and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" I was suddenly struck with this man's charisma, this man who was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead, and he promised me paradise. He promised me that the bullies would stop picking on me, that I would belong, that I wouldn't feel marginalized anymore. The racism isn't something that they lead with. They lead with pride. They lead with acceptance. They lead with a sense of nobility if you were to fight against the enemy. And it was always an us against them narrative. It was always about somebody else's fault for the problems that we were experiencing in our lives, that immigrants were taking our jobs, that blacks were moving into our neighborhoods and increasing crime, and that the Jews were in control of our lives, in control of the media and of the finance systems. I got married at 19 years old, and we had our first child, and I held my child in my arms, and I suddenly reconnected with the innocence that I lost at 14 years old. And I had something tangible to love instead of something to hate, and it changed my priorities. So in 2009, I found the courage to co-found an organization called Life After Hate, which is an organization dedicated to helping people disengage from hate groups and from hateful ideologies. I knew how hard it was for me and for others to leave. Even though we'd lost the ideology, it was difficult to give up that community and that identity. On election day, a bucket of gasoline was kicked over onto all these smoldering sparks that already existed across the U.S. And now the folks who are involved in these movements or in these hateful ideologies feel very emboldened because some of the same things that are being said by our leaders are the same things that we said 30 years ago. Well, we didn't call it the lying press. We called it the Jewish press. We know that that's the same thing. We understand that when they call for a ban on a certain religion, that that's something that we were calling for 30 years ago. You know, when I'm asked what we can do to help solve the xenophobia or the racism, it's a pretty daunting question to try and answer. And what I think we can do is only affect the people that are nearest to us, our family, our friends, our coworkers. And we can do that not by being confrontational or aggressive, but we can do that by listening. Because when we listen, people will inevitably give us the clues on why they may be going down a certain path of hatred or violence or prejudice. These are difficult conversations to have. Nobody likes to have these very uncomfortable conversations, but the truth is we need to, because we're disconnected now more than ever. So my goal is really to just listen, understand, and connect people who might have different backgrounds so that they can realize that we have more similarities than differences.